A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. Four questions about anteaters that sound simple but open into something much stranger. Which country actually has the most anteaters? How old are they, evolutionarily speaking? How closely related are they to sloths? And the big one, do they really spend all day eating ants? The answers turn out to be surprising in every direction, and a lot of what we think we know is just...
It really is. And I love this set of questions because they're connected in a way that isn't obvious at first. Distribution, evolutionary age, phylogeny, diet, they all trace back to the same thing, which is that anteaters are one of the most extremely specialized mammals on the planet. Everything about them is weird and specific and shaped by this long, strange evolutionary trajectory.
Start with the distribution question. Which country actually has the most anteaters? Because I think most people would guess Brazil, and they'd be right. But the story behind that is more interesting than just biggest country wins.
Brazil does take the top spot, and by a substantial margin. Current estimates from the IUCN put the giant anteater population in Brazil at somewhere between 50,000 and 70,000 individuals. That's the giant anteater alone. You also have substantial populations of the other three species within Brazil's borders, the southern tamandua, the northern tamandua, and the silky anteater. But here's what's interesting. The stronghold isn't where most people assume it is.
Everyone pictures the Amazon.
And the Amazon does have anteaters, but the real population centers are the Cerrado and the Pantanal. The Cerrado is this vast tropical savanna, about 2 million square kilometers of grasslands, scrub forest, gallery forests. It's actually the most biodiverse savanna on Earth, and it's absolutely perfect habitat for giant anteaters. Open enough for a large terrestrial mammal to move through, but with enough termite mounds and ant nests to sustain a population. The Pantanal, which is the world's largest tropical wetland, is even denser in some areas. Think of it this way. If you're a giant anteater, the Amazon is like trying to navigate a crowded warehouse. The Cerrado is an open-plan office with snack stations every 50 meters.
It's a savanna animal that we've mentally filed under jungle.
And that misconception shapes conservation priorities in ways that are actually damaging. But before we get to that, the second place country is genuinely surprising.
I was going to ask.
Paraguay has a higher density of giant anteaters per square kilometer than Brazil does. The absolute numbers are lower because the country is smaller, but if you're walking through suitable habitat in the Paraguayan Chaco or the eastern forests, your odds of encountering a giant anteater are higher than almost anywhere else in the world. A 2024 survey in the Pantanal region that crosses the Brazil-Paraguay border revised population estimates upward for both countries. The Paraguayan numbers were particularly striking because they'd been undercounted in earlier assessments.
Paraguay as the anteater density champion. That's the kind of fact that sounds made up but isn't. Like how Mongolia has the most, actually, never mind.
Were you about to claim Mongolia has the most sloths?
I was about to say something completely different and unrelated to anything.
Sure you were. But the biogeography here is important. The current range of the giant anteater stretches from Honduras down through Central America and into northern Argentina, but that range is a fragment of what it used to be. We have fossil evidence of giant anteaters in Sonora, Mexico, as recently as 11,000 years ago. That's the late Pleistocene. They were roaming around what's now the Sonoran Desert, which is hard to imagine when you picture an animal that we now associate with tropical South America.
11,000 years ago is basically yesterday in evolutionary time, so their range has contracted dramatically. How does that even work in practice? An anteater in a desert?
It tells you that the Sonoran Desert of 11,000 years ago was not the Sonoran Desert of today. The late Pleistocene climate was wetter and cooler across much of North America. What's now desert scrub was probably more of a dry woodland with sufficient insect life to support a population of giant anteaters. As the climate warmed and dried into the Holocene, that habitat became unsuitable, and the northern population simply, the anteaters, didn't migrate south in some coordinated retreat. The northern edge of the range just died off, generation by generation, until the species was confined to the latitudes where conditions still worked.
The range contraction isn't a story of anteaters packing up and moving. It's a story of the habitable zone shrinking underneath them.
And that contraction brings us to the second question. How old are anteaters, evolutionarily speaking? Because to understand why their range looks the way it does now, you have to understand the deep history.
All right, take us back.
Anteaters belong to the order Pelosa, which they share with sloths. Pelosa and the order Cingulata, the armadillos, together make up the superorder Xenarthra. This is one of the four major groups of placental mammals, and it's ancient. The split between Pelosa and Cingulata happened around 65 to 70 million years ago, right at the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary. That's the extinction event that wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. So the Xenarthran lineage was already diverging while Tyrannosaurus rex was still walking around.
When people say anteaters are primitive mammals, there's actually a grain of truth to that. They've been a distinct lineage for an extraordinarily long time.
They're not primitive in the sense of being unsophisticated or poorly adapted. They're highly specialized. But the lineage is ancient. The first fossil anteaters appear in the early Miocene, about 20 million years ago. But a major molecular clock study published in early 2026 by Gibb and colleagues pushed the divergence between anteaters and sloths back to about 38 million years ago. That's the late Eocene.
38 million years? For context, what else was happening at that point?
The split between anteaters and sloths is older than the split between humans and old world monkeys. That's about 25 million years. It's older than the divergence of rodents as a modern group, which is about 55 million years, though the Xenarthran stem lineage is older still. The point is that when anteaters and sloths went their separate ways, the Andes hadn't uplifted yet. The Amazon River didn't follow its current course. That drainage pattern didn't establish until about 10 to 11 million years ago. Anteaters as a distinct lineage predate the physical geography of South America as we know it today.
Which explains a lot about their distribution. They weren't adapting to the current landscape. The landscape changed around them.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. The current distribution of anteaters is essentially a relic of a much wider range. During the Great American Biotic Interchange, when the Isthmus of Panama formed about 3 million years ago, Xenarthrans moved north. Ground sloths made it all the way to Alaska. Giant anteaters got as far north as central Mexico. Then the Pleistocene extinctions hit, and the North American populations vanished, along with the ground sloths and a lot of the megafauna. So what we see now is a contracted, southern subset of what was once a much broader presence.
The mammalian equivalent of a retreating glacier.
You can see the signature of that contraction in the genetics. The Gibb study found relatively low genetic diversity in giant anteater populations compared to what you'd expect for a mammal with such a wide range, which suggests a population bottleneck, likely associated with that post-Pleistocene range contraction.
Let me ask about that bottleneck, because I think people hear low genetic diversity and assume it means the species is doomed. But cheetahs have low genetic diversity, and they're still here. How worried should we actually be?
That's a fair question. Low genetic diversity isn't automatically a death sentence. It depends on why the diversity is low and what the population trajectory looks like. In the anteater's case, the bottleneck appears to be relatively recent in evolutionary terms, which means they haven't had time to purge deleterious mutations through selection. Cheetahs went through their bottleneck further back, and natural selection has had more generations to clean up the mess. The anteater situation is more precarious because the genetic homogeneity is paired with ongoing habitat loss. You can survive a bottleneck if your environment stabilizes. If it keeps changing, you need the genetic variation to adapt, and that's exactly what they may lack.
It's not the low diversity alone. It's the combination of low diversity and rapid environmental change.
It's the difference between being in a hole and being in a hole while someone is digging it deeper. So that's the evolutionary depth. Now the third question, how closely related are they to sloths? Because I feel like most people know they're related somehow, but not how, or how far back that connection goes. So anteaters and sloths are sister groups. Within Pelosa, you have two families in the anteater branch, Myrmecophagidae, which includes the giant anteater and the two tamanduas, and Cyclopedidae, which is just the silky anteater. On the sloth side, you have the two extant genera, Bradypus, the three-toed sloths, and Cholepus, the two-toed sloths. The split between these two branches happened, as I mentioned, about 38 million years ago.
Which is deeper than most people realize. I think the mental model is, anteaters and sloths are cousins, but that's like saying humans and baboons are cousins.
That's actually a fair comparison in terms of divergence depth, but they share some really distinctive characteristics, what biologists call synapomorphies. The most obvious is the dentition, or rather, the lack of it. Anteaters have lost their teeth entirely. They're completely edentulous. Sloths have peg-like molars that lack enamel and grow continuously throughout their lives. Both conditions derive from a reduction in dental complexity that started in their common ancestor.
The shared trait isn't having a specific kind of teeth. It's that both lineages independently decided teeth were overrated.
That's one way to put it. They also share extremely low metabolic rates. Anteaters have the lowest body temperature of any placental mammal, 32 to 33 degrees Celsius. That's a full 3 to 4 degrees lower than most mammals. Their metabolic rate is about 40% lower than what you'd predict for an animal of their size. Sloths take this even further. They're the metabolic floor for placental mammals. But anteaters are in that same physiological neighborhood. The claws are a big one. Both groups have enlarged, curved claws on the forelimbs. In sloths, they're for hanging from branches, and in anteaters, they're for tearing open termite mounds and ant nests. The common ancestor almost certainly had these specialized claws, which suggests it was already using them for some kind of foraging, possibly for insects and trees.
What do we know about that common ancestor?
The best reconstruction is that it was a small, arboreal insectivore living in the proto-Amazonian forests of the Eocene. South America was an island continent at that point. It had been isolated from Africa for tens of millions of years, and it wouldn't connect to North America for another 35 million years. So xenarthrons evolved in splendid isolation, filling niches that on other continents were occupied by entirely unrelated groups. The common ancestor of anteaters and sloths was probably something like a small, tree-dwelling animal that used its claws to strip bark and probe for insects. One lineage stayed in the trees and eventually became sloths. The other became more terrestrial and specialized on social insects, ants, and termites.
It's almost like a choose-your-own-adventure at the evolutionary level. You can stay in the canopy and become a sloth, or you can come down to the ground and become an anteater.
That's a charmingly reductive way to frame 38 million years of evolution. But yes, essentially. And here's a fun detail. There's actually a fossil genus from the early Miocene of Patagonia called Protomandua that seems to sit near the base of the anteater lineage. It was about the size of a modern tamandua, and it had traits that suggest it was already transitioning toward a more terrestrial lifestyle, though it probably still spent significant time in trees. It's one of those transitional fossils that makes paleontologists very happy because it captures an evolutionary moment. The point where the anteater lineage was committing to the path that would eventually produce the giant anteater.
A fossil that captures the choose-your-own-adventure moment.
Which brings us to the fourth question, and I think the one people are most confident they know the answer to. Do anteaters actually spend their days eating ants? This is where the myth really collapses. The popular image of the anteater is an animal that wanders around all day with its nose to the ground, constantly licking up ants, spending 12 to 16 hours a day feeding just to get enough calories. That image is wrong in almost every particular. A 2025 study by Medri and colleagues in the Brazilian Pantanal put GPS collars and accelerometers on 12 wild giant anteaters and tracked their actual behavior. They found that giant anteaters spend only 4 to 6 hours per day foraging, not 12, not 16, 4 to 6. And they don't stay at any one nest for long. They visit between 40 and 60 nests per day, but they spend only 30 to 90 seconds at each one. They're not grazing. They're conducting a series of rapid, precise raids.
Hit and run predation.
And here's the thing that really upends the popular narrative. When both are available, giant anteaters prefer termites over ants by a 3-to-1 ratio. They're not anteaters in the sense of primarily eating ants. They're termite specialists who also eat ants.
The name itself is misleading.
the name is a misnomer, and they're selective within those categories. They avoid army ants entirely, too aggressive, too much formic acid, not worth the trouble. They target specific genera, Nasutitermes termites and Camponotus carpenter ants are preferred. They know exactly what they're looking for, and they move on quickly before the colony can mount a defensive response.
How do they know? Is it smell?
Giant anteaters have an extraordinary sense of smell. Their olfactory bulbs are proportionally among the largest of any mammal. They can detect the chemical signatures of specific termite and ant species from a considerable distance, and they seem to learn which nests are worth revisiting and which have been depleted. The GPS data from the Pantanal study showed that they almost never revisit the same nest on consecutive days. They're maintaining a mental map of their foraging territory and rotating through it systematically.
They're not just wandering around hoping to bump into ants. They're working a route.
They're working a route with a level of spatial memory that we're only beginning to appreciate. And the tongue. Everyone talks about the tongue. The tongue is extraordinary, but it's not what people think. It's not for licking up ants like an ice cream cone. It's a ballistic projectile. The giant anteater's tongue can extend up to 60 centimeters, 2 feet, and it flicks in and out up to 150 times per minute. It's coated in extremely sticky saliva produced by enlarged submandibular glands. The tongue shoots into the nest, the insects adhere to it, and it retracts in a fraction of a second. The anteater doesn't have a sticky tongue. It has a biological flypaper strip attached to a pneumatic launcher.
A biological flypaper strip attached to a pneumatic launcher. That's the most Herman Poppleberry sentence ever uttered.
I'll take that as a compliment.
It was meant as one, but this raises a question. Why be so efficient? Why not just graze on ants all day like everyone assumes?
This is where the metabolic story comes full circle. Remember, anteaters have the lowest body temperature of any placental mammal and a metabolic rate 40% below predictions. They're running on a very tight energy budget. Every minute they spend foraging is a minute they're burning calories they can't afford to waste. The social insects they eat are not calorie dense. Termites and ants are mostly chitin and water. So the anteater's entire feeding strategy is built around minimizing time spent feeding while maximizing yield per nest visit.
The specialization is a solution to a problem. How do you survive on a low-calorie diet without spending your entire life eating?
And that's the same problem sloths solved by moving extremely slowly and digesting leaves over the course of weeks. Anteaters took a different route. Instead of slowing down their digestion, they sped up their foraging efficiency to an almost absurd degree. But the underlying constraint is the same. A low-energy diet requires extreme adaptations. Sloths went for minimizing energy expenditure. Anteaters went for maximizing intake rate while still keeping total foraging time low. They're two different solutions to the same metabolic equation.
That equation was set up by that common ancestor 38 million years ago.
The low metabolic rate was already there in the ancestral Xenarthran. Both lineages inherited that constraint and evolved radically different ways of living within it. Sloths became slow-moving folivores. Anteaters became rapid-strike insectivores. But neither of them ever escaped the fundamental limitation of being a low-energy mammal.
Which makes you wonder about the conservation angle. If anteaters are this specialized, this tightly calibrated to a specific foraging strategy, and a specific set of prey, what happens when you disrupt that?
This is the part that keeps conservation biologists up at night. Habitat fragmentation in the Cerrado, which is happening at an alarming rate driven by soy cultivation and cattle ranching, doesn't just remove anteater habitat. It disrupts termite and ant populations. And because anteaters are so specialized, they can't just switch to a different food source. A generalist insectivore like a raccoon can adapt. An anteater can't.
The specialization that made them successful becomes a vulnerability.
That's the paradox of extreme adaptation. The very traits that allowed anteaters to thrive for 38 million years are the traits that make them fragile in the face of rapid environmental change. The IUCN reassessed the giant anteater in 2026 and classified it as vulnerable, with habitat loss in the Cerrado cited as the primary threat. The Pantanal populations are more stable, but the Pantanal itself is threatened by climate change and upstream agricultural runoff.
What does the conservation landscape actually look like? Are there organizations doing effective work on this?
The IPSSSS Institute in Brazil runs a dedicated giant anteater conservation program that's been operating for years. They do GPS tracking, habitat corridor mapping, and work with ranchers to reduce vehicle collisions, which are a major cause of anteater mortality. Giant anteaters don't run from cars. They rear up on their hind legs in a defensive posture, which is effective against jaguars but not against trucks. The IP program has been one of the more successful examples of integrating wildlife conservation with agricultural land use.
That's where individual support can actually make a difference. Directing funding to organizations that are doing the on-the-ground work, rather than just producing awareness campaigns.
And I think there's a broader point here about how we talk about these animals. The cute animal eating ants all day. Trope in nature documentaries isn't just inaccurate, it's actively misleading. It makes anteaters seem like simple, almost comical creatures, when in reality, they're one of the most sophisticated feeding specialists in the mammal world. When you understand the actual biology, the conservation argument becomes much more compelling.
The story shifts from save the charming anteater to preserve a 38-million-year-old evolutionary lineage that represents a unique solution to a fundamental biological problem.
And that's a much stronger case. Nobody's going to chain themselves to a tree for a cartoon character. But for a lineage that predates the Andes, that survived the extinction of the ground sloths, that evolved a feeding mechanism unmatched by any other mammal, that's worth protecting.
You mentioned the ground sloths. It's worth pausing on that. The fact that anteaters are still here while their giant cousins vanished. What allowed them to survive the Pleistocene extinctions when the ground sloths didn't?
That's an open question, and a fascinating one. Ground sloths were herbivores, many of them large-bodied. Megatherium was the size of an elephant. Large herbivores were hit hardest by the Pleistocene extinctions, possibly because of human hunting pressure, possibly because of climate shifts, probably both. Anteaters survived because they were smaller, more cryptic, and their food source, social insects, wasn't affected by the megafaunal collapse. Termites and ants didn't care that the mammoths were gone. So the anteater specialization, which might have seemed like a limitation, turned out to be a survival advantage.
The picky eater outlasted the generalists.
In this case, yes. And that's one of the things that makes the current threat different. The Pleistocene extinctions removed competitors and predators, but they didn't remove the anteater's food base. Habitat fragmentation in the Cerrado does. You can't eat termites if the termite mounds have been bulldozed for soy fields.
The question becomes whether anteaters can adapt to a landscape that's changing faster than any landscape they've faced in their evolutionary history.
That's where the 2025 Pantanal study offers a small thread of hope. The GPS data showed that giant anteaters are more flexible in their foraging behavior than previously assumed. They adjusted their activity patterns based on temperature, being more nocturnal during hot periods, more diurnal during cooler periods. They used a wider variety of habitat types than expected, including agricultural edges. That suggests there's some behavioral plasticity there.
Behavioral plasticity only goes so far when the food source itself is being eliminated.
Flexibility in when you forage doesn't help if there's nothing to eat, and that's the real concern. Not that anteaters can't adjust their schedules, but that the termite and ant communities they depend on are being disrupted at a landscape scale.
Let me pull on a different thread for a moment. You mentioned the immune system angle. Anteaters eat prey that defend themselves with formic acid and venom. How does their immune system handle that?
This is an area of active research, and the 2026 genomic study opened up some really interesting possibilities. Anteaters appear to have modifications in genes related to pain reception and inflammatory response. Essentially, they may be partially resistant to the chemical defenses of their prey. Formic acid, which is the primary defensive compound in many ant species, causes pain and tissue damage in most mammals. Anteaters seem to have evolved a degree of tolerance.
Which makes sense. You can't have your tongue being constantly irritated by the very food you're eating.
And the potential biomedical angle is significant. If we can understand the molecular basis of that formic acid tolerance, it could inform the development of better treatments for chemical burns or even anti-venom therapies. It's a classic case of evolutionary medicine, looking at how natural selection has solved the problem over millions of years and asking whether that solution could be translated for human benefit.
The anteater is a walking pharmacy. That's a better PR angle than weird tube-faced animal eats bugs.
It really is. And it connects to a larger point about biodiversity conservation. We don't know what we're losing. Every species that goes extinct takes with it millions of years of evolutionary problem solving. The anteater's formic acid tolerance might be medically significant, or it might not. We won't know unless we keep them around long enough to find out.
All right, let me try to pull all of this together. We've got four questions, and they all connect. Brazil has the most anteaters, but Paraguay has the highest density. The lineage is ancient. The split from sloths happened 38 million years ago, and the broader Xenarthran lineage goes back to the age of dinosaurs. Anteaters and sloths are sister groups that share low metabolism, reduced dentition, and specialized claws, but they diverged into radically different ecological strategies. And the eating ants all day? Thing is a myth. They're efficient, selective, hit-and-run predators that prefer termites, and spend only a few hours a day actually foraging.
That's the picture, and I think the thread that ties it all together is specialization. Everything about the anteater, its distribution, its evolutionary history, its relationship to sloths, its feeding ecology, is a story about what happens when a lineage commits to an extreme strategy and rides it for tens of millions of years.
The anteater is not a general-purpose mammal that happens to eat ants. It's a precision instrument that evolution has been refining since the Eocene.
That precision is both its triumph and its vulnerability. In a stable world, specialization wins. In a rapidly changing world, it can become a trap.
Which leaves us with the open question, how will anteaters fare as climate change shifts the distribution of the termites and ants they depend on? The early evidence from the Pantanal study suggests they may be more flexible than we assumed, but the data is thin and the pressures are accelerating.
The next 5 to 10 years of research are going to be crucial. We need more long-term tracking studies across different habitat types. We need better population estimates for the tamanduas and the silky anteater, which get much less attention than the giant anteater. And we need to understand the genetic basis of their physiological adaptations before those adaptations are lost.
The four questions Daniel asked turn out to be the entry point to a much larger story about deep time, about extreme adaptation, and about what we stand to lose if we don't pay attention.
About how much of what we think we know is wrong. I think that's the recurring theme of this show, honestly.
It really is. Question the cute animal narrative. Question the nature documentary voiceover. The real story is almost always stranger and more interesting.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1927, Soviet mathematician Alexander Gelfand was exiled to a village near Lake Baikal for refusing to sign a political denunciation. While there, he developed a notation for representing complex exponentiation using a single overlaid symbol, a superscripted arc above the base number, that he later abandoned because typesetters in Moscow couldn't reproduce it. The only surviving examples of the notation appear in his personal correspondence from that year, which is preserved in the archives of the Russian Academy of Sciences.
A notation so obscure, even Soviet typesetters said no.
Gelfand's Ark. Sounds like a lost Indiana Jones artifact.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and if you want to dig deeper into any of the research we talked about today, head to myweirdprompts.com for links to the Gibbs study, the Medri Pantanal paper, and the IP Institute's conservation program.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloths, slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.